Well, maybe we'll get going. Welcome to the second in our Democracy and Moral Conviction public lecture series. Just wanted to thank really quickly the Law School and the Center for Ethics for helping us to fund these events. Today's speaker, it's a great pleasure to introduce to you, Michael Perry, who is currently Robert W. Woodruff Chair at Emory Law School. Previously, he held the University Distinguished Chair at Law in Law at Wake Forest, and at Northwestern, the Howard J. Tiernan's Chair at Law. His 2003 book, Under God, Religious Faith and Liberal Democracy, is the book that the seminar that corresponds with this lecture series has been reading, and this is a very provocative, and I should say in some ways very compelling and interesting and very serious book about the role of religious reason giving and religious faith in liberal democracy, both at the legislative end with making laws and policies, and also at the end with regard to citizenship and the public square, and we'll hear a little bit about that today. His most recent book is called Toward a Theory of Human Rights, and that came out at the end of 2006. But today, his topic will be, is religion a legitimate basis for, constitutionally legitimate basis for lawmaking in the United States? Welcome, Michael Perry. Thank you. Can everybody hear me? All right, in the back. It's a great pleasure and an honor to be with all of you this afternoon. This is my first time ever in Nashville, and therefore at Vanderbilt, which is a little surprising since I was born and raised right after World War II and raised in Louisville, Kentucky, not all that far away. I was kidding Bob when I said it says something about my career that my first visit to Vanderbilt is mainly under the auspices of the philosophy department. The title of my lecture, I want to, before I begin to present the lecture, those of you in the seminar who have read my book Under God, the second chapter of that book is titled Why Political Reliance on Religiously Grounded Morality Does Not Violate the Establishment Clause. The position I'm going to defend today is contrary to the position I defended in this chapter of this book that was published in 2003. So that should make for some interesting discussion later today. And the title of this lecture, Is Religion a Constitutionally Legitimate Basis of Lawmaking, Herein of the Non-Establishment of Religion? The question I address in this lecture, which is the question that is the title of the lecture, should not be confused with a different question that has been vigorously contested in the United States for the last 30 years or so, namely, is religion, religious rationales, a morally legitimate basis of lawmaking in a liberal democracy? I have addressed that question elsewhere, as have many others. In my judgment, the answer is yes. And the most powerful defense of that answer is philosopher Christopher Eberle's important book, Religious Conviction in Liberal Politics, which was published in 2002, and which the seminar is read, I understand. The question I address here is about constitutional legitimacy, not moral, political moral legitimacy. Moreover, it's about constitutional legitimacy in a particular liberal democracy, the United States of America. Like other liberal democracies, the United States is constitutionally committed to the right to freedom of religious practice. Unlike most other liberal democracies, however, the United States is also constitutionally committed to the non-establishment of religion. According to the constitutional law of the United States, government, that is, lawmakers and other government officials, may neither prohibit the free exercise of religion nor establish religion. Does the non-establishment norm, as we may call it, as I prefer to call it, ban religion as a basis of lawmaking? More precisely, should the non-establishment norm be understood to ban laws and policies for which the only discernible rationale, or at least the only discernible rationale other than an implausible secular rationale, is religious? Now take my word for it that according to a constitutional norm other than the non-establishment norm, an implausible secular rationale, by which I mean a secular rationale that rational, well-informed, and thoughtful fellow citizens could not affirm, is constitutionally inadequate. A rationale, R, is the only discernible rationale for a law if it is difficult to the point of impossible to discern a reason for enacting the law other than R. I conclude in this lecture that the answer to the question whether the non-establishment norm should be understood to ban laws for which the only discernible rationale is religious depends. Yes, with respect to some religious rationales, no, with respect to others. I also conclude, however, that insofar as the non-establishment norm is concerned, lawmakers are free to support laws, to vote to enact laws, on the basis of any religious rationale whatsoever. Those two conclusions may seem to pull in opposite directions. I explain in this lecture why they do not. Now, the next section of my lecture is called The Central Meaning of the Non-Establishment Norm. The idea of an established church is familiar. For Americans, the best known and most relevant example is the Church of England, which from before the time of the American founding to the present has been the established church in England, though obviously much more strongly established in the past than today. In the United States, however, unlike in England, there may be no established church. The non-establishment norm forbids government to treat any church as the official church of the political community. When I say any church, I mean to include any range of theologically kindred churches. For example, Christian churches, which, though denominationally diverse, are sometimes referred to in the singular, as the Christian church. More precisely, to say the government may not establish religion is to say the government may not favor any church. Page is out of order, forgive me. May not favor any church in relation to any other church on the basis of the view that the favored church, as a community of faith, better along one or another dimension of value. Truer, for example, or more efficacious spiritually, or more authentically American. So government may not privilege in law or policy membership in any church, in the Fifth Avenue Baptist Church, for example, or in the Roman Catholic Church or in the Christian Church generally. Nor may it privilege a worship practice, a prayer, liturgical rite, or religious observance, or a theological doctrine distinctive of any church. There is no serious controversy among constitutional scholars, jurists, or lawyers in the United States today, I think, about the central meaning of the non-establishment norm. The norm centrally means it centrally forbids what the preceding paragraph said it means. There are serious controversies, however, about what the non-establishment norm forbids, that is, about what it should be understood to forbid beyond what it centrally forbids. So let's turn to one such controversy. Given its uncontested central meaning, should the non-establishment norm be understood to forbid government to affirm religious, theological premises? There are many different ways in which government in the United States affirms or has affirmed one or more religious premises. Here are some prominent examples. In 1954, the Congress of the United States added the words "under God" to the Pledge of Allegiance. Also in 1954, Congress requested that all U.S. coins and paper currency bear the slogan, "In God We Trust." On July 11, 1955, President Eisenhower made this slogan mandatory on all currency, "In God We Trust." In 1956, the national motto was changed from "E Pluribus Unum" to "In God We Trust." The proceedings of many courts in the United States, including the Supreme Court of the United States, begin with a court official intoning, "God save the United States and this honorable court." Some states provided that their public schools should begin the day with Bible reading or prayer. Some state officials, including some state judges, posted the Ten Commandments on government property, such as a public school classroom or hallway, a courtroom wall, or a courthouse lawn. In some such instances, government was affirming one or more religious premises. Is the non-establishment norm best understood to forbid government to affirm any religious premise whatsoever, no matter what the premise? I am about to sketch two different understandings of what the non-establishment norm forbids. But it bears emphasis that no sensible understanding of what the norm forbids denies either of the two following propositions. First, the non-establishment norm forbids government to affirm any religious premise whose affirmation by government would violate the central meaning of the norm. For example, government may not affirm explicitly or implicitly, directly or indirectly, that Jesus is Lord or that the Roman Catholic Church is the one true church. Second, if there are one or more religious premises the government may affirm, one or more premises, that is, whose affirmation by government would not violate the central meaning of the non-establishment norm, government, in affirming... Now, I am not sure what happened here, but hopefully this won't happen again. Government, in affirming such a premise, may not coerce anyone to affirm the premise or disadvantage anyone who refuses to do so. Those were the two propositions that no sensible understanding of the norm, I think, would deny. Now, given the central meaning of the non-establishment norm, the first proposition follows as night follows day. We don't need the non-establishment norm to warrant the second proposition. The free exercise norm, the right to the free exercise of religion, is sufficient. As a moment's reflection will confirm, the free exercise norm protects not only one's freedom to practice one's own religion, but also one's freedom not to practice, not to participate in someone else's religion, or indeed any religion at all. That negative freedom, that freedom not to practice a religion one does not accept, includes the freedom not to affirm a religious premise one does not accept. Now, imagine two different understandings of what, in the context at hand, the non-establishment norm forbids. According to the first and more restrictive understanding, government may not affirm any religious premise whatsoever. According to the second and less restrictive understanding, government may affirm any religious premise whatsoever whose affirmation by government would not violate the central meaning of the norm. The more restrictive understanding would make sense only if there were no religious premises whose affirmation by government would not violate the central meaning of the non-establishment norm. But there are religious premises whose affirmation by government does not violate the central meaning of the norm. A single example will suffice. Since 1954, the Pledge of Allegiance has echoed Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address in declaring that we are one nation under God. At Gettysburg, Lincoln resolved that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom. In affirming with Lincoln that ours is a nation that stands under the judgment of a righteous God, government is not treating any church or any range of theologically kindred churches as the official church of the political community. Government is not favoring any church in relation to any other church on the basis of the view that the favored church is, as a church, as a community of faith, better along one or another dimension of value. Government is not privileging membership in, a worship practice of, or a doctrine distinctive of any church. There is a second reason, a practical reason, to be wary about the more restrictive understanding. Relatively few citizens of the United States would take seriously, very few would tolerate, a constitutional provision according to which having under God in the pledge or in God we trust as the national motto are beginning a session of court with God Save the United States and this honorable court is unconstitutional. Such a provision would be widely regarded and widely dismissed as extreme. One might say that the practical reason is a bad reason, at the very least a problematic reason for rejecting a good, accurate, proper understanding of a constitutional norm, no doubt. But the question here is precisely what is a good understanding? Indeed, what is the best understanding of the non-establishment norm? The first reason responds to that question. The second reason reinforces the first and determinative reason. The less restrictive understanding of what the non-establishment norm forbids in this context makes more sense than the more restrictive understanding, because there are at least some religious premises whose affirmation by government does not or would not violate the central meaning of the non-establishment norm. Moreover, the less restrictive understanding does not entail a conclusion, namely that having under God in the pledge or in God we trust as the national motto and so forth, violates the constitutional imperative that government not establish religion. It doesn't entail a conclusion that most citizens of the United States would greet as ridiculously extreme. Let's look more closely at the less restrictive understanding, according to which, again, having under God in the pledge or the like does not violate the non-establishment norm. Would it violate the non-establishment norm, according to the less restrictive understanding, to have under Christ in the pledge, one nation under Christ, or in Christ we trust, or Jesus is Lord as our national motto, or to begin a session of the court with Christ Save the United States in this honorable court? To arrive at the right answer, we must inquire, in adding under Christ to the pledge, is government treating any church or any range of theologically kindred churches as the official church of the political community? Is it favoring any church in relation to any other on the basis of the view that the favored church is, as a church, as a community of faith, better along one or another dimension of value? It seems undeniable that in adding under Christ to the pledge, government is treating the Christian church, the Christian church as a whole, though not any particular denomination of it, as the official church of the political community. Government is favoring the Christian church in relation to other churches and communities of faith on the basis of the view that the Christian church is, as a church, as a community of faith, better along one or another dimension of value. So according to the less restrictive understanding of what the non-establishment norm forbids, having under God in the pledge would violate the norm. Religious liberty scholar, law professor at Cornell, Stephen Schifrin, has argued that the United States has evolved from a country that is historically Christian into a country that is, he says, quote, officially monotheistic. I'm going to quote Steve. He says, proponents of a high wall between church and state who would remove under God from the Pledge of Allegiance are wishing for a country that does not exist and probably never will. Our Constitution must be interpreted in the light of our evolving traditions, like it or not, so we make compromises, and today government can say in God we trust on its coins, but not in Christ we trust, says Steve Schifrin. His claim that the United States is now officially monotheistic is, I think, substantially correct. At least the claim is congruent with what I am contending here. For government to affirm any religious premise or premises, any premise that is ecumenical, non-sectarian, as among the great monotheistic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, would not be for it to violate the non-establishment norm. By contrast, for government to affirm any religious premise that is sectarian as among the monotheistic faiths would be for it to violate the non-establishment norm. In affirming any religious premise that is not ecumenical as among Christians, religious Jews, and Muslims, for example, the premise that Jesus is Lord, government is violating the non-establishment norm even according to the less restrictive understanding of what the norm forbids. Why shouldn't one go further and embrace an understanding of the non-establishment norm according to which government would violate the norm if the religious premise it affirmed, although ecumenical as among the monotheistic faiths, is sectarian as between, on the one side, the monotheistic phase, and on the other side, Hinduism, Buddhism, and other non-monotheistic faiths. An understanding of the non-establishment norm according to which government may not affirm any religious premise Hindus, Buddhists, etc. reject would require us to reach the conclusion that having under God in the pledge, or in God we trust as the national motto, or beginning a session of court with God save the United States and this honorable court, or the like, is unconstitutional. The God in all those iterations is undeniably the Abrahamic God, the one true God who creates and sustains us out of love. The Abrahamic God is not one of the members of the Hindu pantheon of divinities, nor is the Abrahamic God or any other divinity affirmed by Buddhists who are in the main non-theistic. We should reject that conclusion because, as I've explained, the central meaning of the non-establishment norm does not support it. Indeed, no historically grounded reading of the norm, no reading grounded in American history, supports that conclusion. It is undeniably true that having under God in the pledge, in God we trust is the national motto and the like, offends some citizens of the United States, maybe some of you. Nonetheless, so long as government fully respects one's right to the free exercise of religion, government's affirmation of one or more religious premises does not violate anyone's human rights. Consider in that regard the Constitution of the Republic of Ireland, which makes a number of theological affirmations, but also vigorously protects every Irish citizen's right to freedom of religious practice. Consider, too, that the International Law of Human Rights, which features the right to freedom of religious practice, does not include anything like a non-establishment norm. Indeed, in particular, the Declaration on the Elimination of All Forms of Intolerance and of Discrimination Based on Religion or Belief, which is the principal international document concerning religious freedom, includes nothing like a non-establishment requirement. Is it really the case that the more restrictive understanding of what the non-establishment norm forbids in this context yields the conclusion that having under God in the pledge or in God we trust as the national motto, etc., is unconstitutional? Is there a way for one who accepts the more restrictive understanding to avoid that conclusion? A conclusion that, as I said, most citizens of the United States would greet as ridiculously extreme. Consider the suggestion that having under God in the pledge or in God we trust as the national motto is not unconstitutional because such statements do not really constitute an affirmation by government of a religious premise. Instead, such statements are merely patriotic or ceremonial utterances devoid of authentically religious content. In 1983, Supreme Court Justice William Brennan, joined by Justice Thurgood Marshall, wrote, "I frankly do not know what should be the proper dispositions of features of our public life, such as God save the United States and this honorable court, in God we trust, one nation under God, and the like. I might well adhere to the view that such mottos are consistent with the Establishment Clause because they have lost any true religious significance." In 2004, Chief Justice William Rehnquist, joined by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, said something similar, and I quote, "The phrase under God is in no sense a prayer nor an endorsement of any religion. Reciting the pledge or listening to others recite it is a patriotic exercise, not a religious one. Participants promise fidelity to our flag and our nation, not to any particular God, faith, or church." Asserting that one nation under God or in God we trust are merely patriotic or ceremonial utterances devoid of authentically religious content is obviously a convenient strategy for avoiding the conclusion that under the more restrictive understanding of the non-establishment norm, having under God in the pledge or in God we trust as our national motto is unconstitutional. It is also a palpably disingenuous strategy. There are some citizens, no doubt, for whom the statements are merely ceremonial, religiously empty utterances. It is simply mistaken, however, to think that the statements are religiously empty for most or even for many citizens of the United States, or that they were religiously empty for the members of Congress who in 1954 added "under God" to the pledge. For most Americans, the statements resonate, as indeed they were meant to, with an authentically enriched theological content. That there is a God, that God created us and sustains us, that every human being has a God-given dignity and inviolability, and that, as Lincoln proclaimed in his second inaugural, we stand under the judgment of that righteous God. There is no intellectually honest way for one who accepts the more restrictive understanding of the non-establishment norm to avoid the conclusion that having "under God" in the pledge or "in God we trust" as the national motto or the like is unconstitutional. For one who is intellectually honest, to accept the more restrictive understanding is to accept that conclusion. Now I finally get in this final section to the question I've been working my way up to: does the non-establishment norm, properly understood, ban religion as a basis of lawmaking? We're now in a position to address the question that is the title of this lecture: is religion a legitimate, constitutionally legitimate, basis of lawmaking in the United States? More precisely, should the non-establishment norm be understood to ban laws and policies for which the only discernible rationale, at least other than an implausible secular rationale, is religious? Two clarifications. First, the principal laws at issue are those that are coercive. Because coercive laws for which the only discernible rationale is religious seem to some to be a kind of religious imposition on those they coerce. Kent Greenewalt, for example, has written of laws, quote, "that enforce a purely religious morality, that they unacceptably impose religion on others." And he gives as an example, quote, "laws against homosexual relations based on the view that the Bible considers such relations sinful." Second, by a religious rationale, I mean a rationale that depends, at least in part, on a religious premise. A secular rationale, by contrast, does not depend on any religious premise. By a religious premise, I mean, in this context, a premise, a claim about the existence, nature, activity, or will of God, such as the premise that same-sex marriage is contrary to the will of God. I argued in the preceding section that according to the most balanced understanding of what it forbids, the non-establishment norm forbids government to affirm some religious premises, but that it also leaves room for government to affirm some religious premises, namely, premises whose affirmation by government does not or would not violate the central meaning of the non-establishment norm. It follows from that argument that the non-establishment norm should not be understood to ban laws for which the only discernible rationale is a religious rationale that depends on a premise or premises that government may affirm, because its doing so does not or would not violate the central meaning of the non-establishment norm, such as the premise that every human being has a God-given dignity and inviolability. It also follows, however, that the non-establishment norm should be understood to ban laws for which the only discernible rationale is a religious rationale that depends on, and in that sense affirms, a religious premise that government may not affirm. A lawmaker supports a law, she votes to enact a law, on the basis of a religious rationale, if but for the religious rationale, if in the absence of the religious rationale, she would not vote to enact the law. Put another way, a lawmaker votes to enact a law on the basis of a religious rationale if there is no secular rationale that by itself would move her to enact the law. However, the non-establishment ban I am articulating here is indifferent to whether a lawmaker who voted to enact a law actually did so, either wholly or partly, on the basis of an offending religious rationale, a rationale that depends on a religious premise government may not affirm. There are several good reasons for that indifference. It is unrealistic to expect most lawmakers to have a confident answer to the question whether they would have voted to enact a law but for an offending religious rationale. The ban, as a legal ban, is meant to be, in theory at least, judicially enforceable. If most lawmakers themselves don't have a confident answer to the question whether they would have voted to enact a law but for an offending religious rationale, how is a court supposed to know whether they would have done so? Moreover, if courts were in the business of speculating about whether the lawmakers would have voted to enact a law but for an offending religious rationale, some lawmakers would respond by engaging in strategic behavior aimed at making it appear that they would have voted to enact the law on the basis of a plausible secular rationale and are a non-offending religious rationale. Finally, consider this scenario. A court speculates that the lawmakers in state A would have voted to enact law L on the basis of a plausible secular rationale and therefore concludes that L is not unconstitutional. While a different court speculates that the lawmakers in state B would not have voted to enact the very same law on the basis of any plausible secular rationale and therefore concludes that L is unconstitutional. In state A, L is constitutional. In state B, L is unconstitutional. What an unseemly state of affairs that would be. So the non-establishment norm is better understood not to forbid a lawmaker to support a law on the basis of an offending religious rationale, but only to ban laws for which the only discernible rationale is an offending religious rationale. As a practical matter, how significant is a ban on such laws? In the United States today, there are, and in the foreseeable future, there will be, almost no actual or proposed laws, at least almost no proposed laws that have a realistic chance of becoming actual laws, that fit the profile, laws for which the only discernible rationale is an offending religious rationale. For example, and as I have explained elsewhere, a plausible secular rationale, a secular rationale that rational, well-informed, and thoughtful fellow citizens could and do affirm, is discernible for laws banning most abortions. There is one policy, however, with respect to which the ban may have some bite. Many states refuse to recognize. They refuse to extend the benefit of law to same-sex unions. If no plausible secular rationale for such a policy is discernible, if the only discernible rationale depends on the premise that same-sex unions are contrary to the will of God, this becomes the determinative question. May government affirm the premise that same-sex unions are contrary to the will of God? Though it's no part of my lecture, let me tell you that in work that I'm doing elsewhere, I find it enormously difficult to discern a plausible secular rationale for the failure to extend the benefit of law to same-sex unions, which makes this analysis more consequential. As I said at the beginning of this lecture, the principal question at issue here, whether religious rationales, is a constitutionally basis of lawmaking, legitimate basis of lawmaking in the United States, should not be confused with a different question that has been contested in the United States and elsewhere for the last 30 years or so. Is religion a morally legitimate basis of lawmaking in a liberal democracy? More precisely, is it morally legitimate for legislators in a liberal democracy to enact laws on the basis of a religious rationale? Again, that the answer to that question, in my judgment, is yes. But some who give that answer may be inclined to think that the non-establishment ban articulated and defended here, the ban on laws for which the only discernible rationale is an offending religious rationale, is unduly restrictive of religious believers. So let me explain why they should resist that thought. First, laws for which the only discernible rationale depends on a religious premise government may affirm including the premise that every human being has a God-given dignity and inviolability, are not subject to the ban. Second, although laws for which the only discernible rationale is an offending religious rationale are subject to the ban, in the United States today there are, and in the foreseeable future there will be, as I just remarked, few if indeed any actual or proposed laws that fit that profile. The serious question then is not whether the non-establishment ban on laws for which the only discerning rationale is an offending religious rationale is unduly restrictive, but whether as a practical matter the ban has any bite at all. Moreover, insofar as the non-establishment norm is concerned, a lawmaker is free to support a law on the basis of any religious rationale whatsoever, even an offending religious rationale. She is free to support a law that, but for an offending religious rationale, a rationale that depends on a religious premise that under the non-establishment norm government may not affirm, she would not vote to enact. As it happens, however, the vast majority of religious believers in the United States offer non-religious rationales for their political positions on controversial moral issues. So I quote a commentator who says, quote, "Most religious conservatives do frequently and loudly make arguments for their positions on non-theological grounds. The evils of abortion, the value of heterosexual monogamy, the cost of promiscuity and pornography, all these issues are constantly being raised by social conservatives without appeals to the divine inspiration of the Bible," says the commentator. So again, the serious question is not whether the non-establishment ban on laws for which the only discernible rationale is an offending religious rationale is unduly restrictive, but whether as a practical matter the ban has any bite at all. The right to freedom of religious practice is widely regarded as a human right to which every government should be committed and to which liberal democracy as such is committed. I have not argued in this lecture that every government or even every liberal democracy should be committed to the non-establishment of religion. Whether it is a good thing on balance that government in the United States is constitutionally forbidden to establish religion, and whether it would be a good thing on balance for government in, say, the United Kingdom to be forbidden to establish religion, are separate questions. And an affirmative answer to the former question does not entail an affirmative answer to the latter, although an affirmative answer to the latter question may be correct. It is often the case that, as Kent Greenewalt has written, what principles of restraint, if any, are appropriate depend on time and place, on a sense of the present makeup of a society, of its history, and of its likely evolution. Is it a good thing, on balance, that government in the United States is constitutionally forbidden to establish religion? So far as I can tell, there is a virtual consensus among us citizens of the United States that, all things considered, it is good both for religions and for social harmony that our lawmakers, state as well as federal, may not establish religion. The serious question among us, therefore, is not whether the constitutional law of the United States should include the non-establishment norm, but what the non-establishment norm should be understood to mean, to forbid, in one or another context. In this lecture, I asked what the non-establishment norm, given its central meaning, should be understood to forbid in the context of lawmaking. Should it be understood to ban laws for which the only discernible rationale is religious? My answer? Yes, but only if the rationale depends on a religious premise that under the non-establishment norm, government may not affirm. Thank you very much.
We'll give those who have to go to another class, and I'll be the one to field them. So if you have a question, put your hand up. Okay, Caleb Quentin.
Thank you. When I, as a Christian of a certain sort, a certain specific sort, S, let's call it, hear under God, under your interpretation of it, such that it's okay, I have no connection to it. It's non-sectarian, it's religiously hollowed out, and it's not my God. Civic religion, I think, is idolatrous. Why not just take it out?
It's not the God that Roman Catholics recognize as the one true God.
It may be what they recognize,
but not,
that's not my certain sort.
So what God is it?
I don't know. It's not mine.
Well, I made a claim that the God and under God, one nation under God, the God to whom Lincoln was referring at Gettysburg, is precisely the God that Christians, religious Jews, and Muslims worship.
Well,
so you're taking issue with the claim?
Yes, I'm taking issue with that claim. I would think that a Christian of a certain sort, a specific sort, that has a certain sort of religious identity, would want to say, no, in as much as this is a God that could be identified across theological lines and devoid of religious specificity, it would be idolatrous of me
to affirm that. Theologically, I find that very unorthodox. I mean, all my life I've learned that the God that we Roman Catholics and Christians generally worship is the same God, of course, that religious Jews worship. After all, the Palestinian Jew, Jesus was a Palestinian Jew, and the same God that Muslims worship. So I'm not sure where to go with this particular conversation, because what you're saying is so antithetical to what I've learned theologically all of my life, that which is to say, no matter how sectarian or particular the Muslim or the Jew or the Christian might be, the God that is being worshipped is the same God, the one true God.
I would think that the specificity, I mean, the devil's in the details, so to speak. I guess that'd have to come up with a better metaphor given the nature of what we're talking about. But in any case, I would think that, in some sense, what I mean when I refer to God here, in so many respects, is built into the specificity of what I think that entails and how that applies. And as it turns out, if I can't give any specificity to it without violating the non-establishment clause on this weaker interpretation, I would think, hey, I'd rather be a separatist of sorts than to affirm something that I would find
Who
offensive.
Said you couldn't give any specificity to it? What we say is government can't give any specificity.
Right, but I wouldn't want that on my coins or in my pledges either, because it seems to me when I take the Pledge of Allegiance, I'm affirming something which I, from a religious standpoint now, view
the fact that you affirm this is true, and that you also believe that this is true as well, and this is in the middle of the rest, doesn't call into question your affirmation of all this out here. I just don't get it.
To the extent that I'm being required to affirm something which lacks specificity.
First of all, you're not being required to affirm anything. I was very careful about it.
Okay, let's say that now it's acceptable for the government to affirm something which lacks religious theological specificity. It seems to me that if my religious identity is contingent upon a certain specific understanding of a religious claim, then it seems to me that it might be the case that one might say that to the degree that now the state can affirm a theologically diluted conception of God, for instance, that is a certain sort of establishment which I, as a more specific theologian, might affirm to be in violation of my own view of religion, right?
You might.
So it could be the case now that the state is affirming or establishing some sort of religion, albeit a very theologically vacuous sort of God.
You say a diluted. I don't understand what's diluted about it. The fact, I mean, an apophatic Christian, right? That is to say, a Christian, this is very orthodox, and although it's not the whole of Christianity, who's very wary about God talk, who is a minimalist when it comes to God talk, who understands with Thomas Aquinas that the most you can do is, you know, via negativa, make claims about what or who God is not, and also make claims, analogical claims. God is like a loving mother. Somebody who is theologically minimalist in that fashion, an apophatic Christian, is not going to find under God or in God we trust as a diluted conception of God. To the contrary, such a person might find that we're better as far as our national community to let it go at that. And it's not as if that's inconsistent
with your affirmation of a more precise and particular understanding of God, Trinitarian, what have you, in your community. Like I said, the fact that you confirm that there is a God, the nation stands under the judgment of a righteous God, and so on and so forth, is not to take issue with all of the other things. It doesn't contradict all of the other things that you affirm. So I guess I don't know what to say other than that I have trouble understanding why one who affirms all of the other things that you affirm would object to affirming this, object to government affirming this piece of it as idolatrous.
I'm a little bit confused about how you can endorse Everly's conviction that we have no moral reason to restrain, to exercise restraint when advocating public policies that we can only come up with a religious reason for, and at the same time claim that the Establishment Clause, as you interpret it, does require such restraints, that we shouldn't pass laws that the only reason for passing them would be religiously grounded. Because it seems to me that, if we have reasons, unless you want to claim that the Establishment Clause, as you interpret it, is just a mistake, and that we don't, we really have no reason. It's constitutionally established, but there's no moral, it has no moral backing. Because if we have reasons for thinking that we should adhere to the Non-Establishment Clause, as you've interpreted it, and it seems like we have, therefore, moral reasons why we shouldn't, on moral grounds, pursue public policies that we can only come up with religious reasons for adopting. So I don't understand how we could claim on the one hand that we're not morally required to do that, but for some reason we have this legal obligation that we should not otherwise endorse, unless we think we have moral reasons for endorsing that legal obligation.
Are you in the seminar?
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm going to respond now. We can chew on this some more later today. I take it as a given for purposes of this lecture that the non-establishment norm, and it's not controversial, what I'm about to say, is a basic aspect of American constitutional law. Now, one could put that into question. One could say it would be better off if it weren't true. But I take that as a given. That we have, and so the serious question is, how are we going to understand it? What is it going to mean? Now, there are some religious liberty scholars, and I mentioned this in one of the footnotes to the paper, who I'm swimming against the tide here, whose position would be that government may not affirm any religious premise whatsoever, right? And that actually in the academy, and also in terms of the rhetoric of many Supreme Court opinions, is the more attractive position, or the more orthodox position. But I'm skeptical that that is really the position of the court, because the de facto position, of course, is that the court is going to permit one nation under God and God we trust on the coins. You can be sure, you can safely bet your money, I think, on the fact the court's not going to strike that down. So I think the de facto position is rather the position that I am trying to articulate in my lecture. Now, another possible position would not be the one that says no religious premises whatsoever. It wouldn't be my position. It would be the position that I defended in chapter 2 of my book, Under God, which says that any that if the only discernible rationale for a law or policy is a religious rationale, a rationale that depends on a religious premise, then no matter what the religious premise is, that's okay insofar as the Establishment Clause is concerned. And I think Chris Everly would find that more congenial, obviously, as I found it more congenial when I was writing chapter 2 of my book. I just can't bring myself to... It seems to me that if we have a non-establishment norm, for government to be enacting laws and policies on the basis of sectarian theological premises is in fact... That is what I don't know any other way to understand. I mean, sure, there are other ways, there are other instances of establishment. Having particular prayers, sectarian religious rites. But I just can't bring myself to deny that that also is an establishment of
the theological doctrine distinctive of a particular church, a range of, you know, theologically kindred churches. Now, what happened was when I was teaching a course in not in religion and politics, but in constitutional law, and I said to my students in passing a couple of years ago, just take my word for it, if the explanation or rationale for this law is religious, that's not a problem under the non-establishment norm, no matter what the rationale is. Thinking, you know, if you want to see my argument in that regard, read chapter 2 of Under God. My students were very skeptical about that, and then I began to worry and to get skeptical about it and decided to go back to the drawing board and think about it afresh. And as I did, I finally worked myself to the position where, given that the non-establishment norm is a part of our constitutional law, it's very hard for me to deny that it is an establishment for government to base, for there to be laws for which the only discernible rationale is a rationale that affirms a premise that's distinctive of particular churches. Now, I agree with Chris Epperly with respect to the other issue. That's the position I defended in chapter 3 of Under God, and that's I'm a cheerleader for Chris Epperly. I agree with him about that. I just think that this is a different issue. This is an issue not of the political morality of liberal democracy, but of what you have to make a choice with respect to how to understand this norm that is, in fact, a part of our constitutional law. So we can talk about it.
Well, that's right. That's right. There are a number of things going on here. If the best understanding of the norm were one that the majority rejected, then I'd say, as a matter of, as you put it, legal scholarship, then the majority be damned, right? The question for me is, what is the best understanding of the non-establishment norm? And remember, we are not. We're talking constitutional law here. Yeah.
Yeah, but look, you say that the interpretation has to do with any line of value, truth included, right? Affirming the preference for a particular religion along one of these lines of value, truth included. That's right. Now, the Zen Buddhist would say, well, but in saying in God we trust, the government is affirming a religion.
It is undeniably affirming a religious premise. The question is it violating the non-establishment norm, which in my understanding forbids government to be privileging particular churches or ranges of theologically kindred churches.
Right.
Right.
Why isn't this a...
Well, because I don't think that Muslims, religious Jews, and Christians comprise or constitute a theologically kindred church. Right, the non-establishment norm is principally about establishing a church.
But you yourself said a minute ago that you've always learned that these groups worship the same God.
That's right, exactly. But I'll repeat to you what I just said. there is a difference between affirming a theological premise that is common to, you know, across several churches or religions or theological traditions, and affirming a or privileging a particular church or range of theologically kindred churches. I don't understand in what maybe it's the I need to elaborate or be more specific with the idea of theologically kindred churches. What I'm talking about there is, for example, and this is of course relevant given our history, privileging the Christian church or the Protestant Christian church. That's not what one is doing.
The Abrahamic church.
That's the Abrahamic church. I know of no such church.
That is stipulated by
her. Yeah, well, I think that unless we're going to collapse the distinction between church and theological premise, I mean, we can do that. The position that says the best understanding of the non-establishment norm is one according to which government may not affirm any theological or religious premise whatsoever, that would be, of course, the path to take, the one you're suggesting. Now, let me respond to the opening comment you made, because it seems to me a very important comment, and it is this, that if we were talking about political theory, not constitutional law, and we were to say, we could imagine a conversation that said, should we want our political theory, our political morality to comprise a non-establishment norm? But let's assume it does. And the conversation is instead about what's the best understanding of that norm. And then you and I could go back and forth on that, and that would be one discussion. But we're talking about a piece of American constitutional law. And so when you defend something as the best understanding of the non-establishment norm, you have to have in the back of your mind some understanding of what it means to interpret the Constitution, what the Supreme Court could legitimately say a constitutional provision or a constitutional norm means. And my suggestion is that in terms of American history, it just isn't going to fly to suggest the best understanding of this constitutional legal provision read against our history, against our historical background, that the best understanding is one according to which government may not affirm any theological premise whatsoever. I mean, my God, look at our history. The Thanksgiving Day proclamations and so on and so forth. So my struggle is to identify an understanding of the norm that I think is true to the history and will at least be somewhat more resonant for interested citizens thinking about this debate. But my real ambition here is to, not that I'm not interested in this question on its own, but what I'm interested now in doing is turning to the question of same-sex marriage. Because it seems to me, and I'll defend this in another forum, it seems to me that in fact there may well be no plausible secular rationale for refusing to extend the benefit of law to same-sex unions. And I think that we all know intuitively, don't we, that what really animates the people's opposition to extending the benefit of law to same-sex marriage is a feeling that same-sex sexual intimacy is immoral. And they believe that, basically in this country, on religious grounds. It's a religiously grounded morality. It's contrary to the will of God as revealed in the Bible. Don't ask me why it's contrary to the will of God. That I can't tell you. But I can tell you that it is contrary to the will of God, and it would be wrong for the United States or any state to affirm, to give its imprimatur to, same-sex sexual intimacy in this way. Well, I think my take on what the non-establishment norm should be understood to mean is a much more plausible take as a constitutional matter, as a matter of American constitutional law construed against the background of our history and traditions, certainly going to be more acceptable to the people than the one that says under God and all of that is unconstitutional, you can't have it. But it has enough bite, my understanding, that I think it can do some serious work in the analysis of the constitutionality of a state's refusal to extend the benefit of law to same-sex unions.
the central tenets of liberalism, if any of that part of the book, sort of the chapter one stuff, whether you've moved anywhere in that?
No, I actually have done some writing that the book I published a few months ago, the first part of the book, is more about that, but the position hasn't changed. It's maybe become more elaborate. But it seems to me that many people understand liberal democracy, to be constitutively committed to the inherent dignity and inviolability of every human being, and on the basis of that, to establishing and protecting certain fundamental legal rights, one of which is the right to freedom of religious practice. So my thinking about those, we can talk about this evening, but my thinking hasn't changed. I've elaborated it more in some things that I've written, but it certainly hasn't changed. I do think, though, that, of course, to the extent that liberal democracy is, as such, committed to freedom of religious practice, it follows that the only kind of establishment of religion a liberal democracy may engage in is going to be very weak, very thin and very weak. Right, it's not going to be anything like an establishment that lets there be certain privileges or disadvantages flowing from one's membership in a particular church. So, we're talking, given the commitment to freedom, to the right to freedom of religious practice, we're talking about a very a kind of weak establishment in the first place. That would be possible even without the commitment to non-establishment. It should matter if the law is already on the books, and it's been on the books for a long time, and somebody has standing, as lawyers say, it's a real enough issue for the person that we can understand why they're in court challenging this old law. The fact that the law is on the books doesn't privilege the law. It shouldn't privilege the law insofar as the constitutional question is concerned. So I'm open to other suggestions along those lines, but it just seems to me it's the fact that it's on the most laws that are challenged constitutionally are on the books. In fact, you can't challenge a law, and you can't challenge a law in the making. It has to actually be on the books before you can challenge it. Some laws are on the books only a little while before people want to challenge them, but sometimes look at abortion, anti-abortion laws. They were on the books for a long, long time, right? Before many of them were, and they were certainly subject to constitutional challenge. So I don't think that the fact that the law has been on the books for a while makes any difference. But when you talk about both sides, the argument for extending the benefit of law to same-sex unions, as I understand it, is you can't say about it that policy position. You can't say that the only discernible rationale for that policy position is an offending religious rationale, right? Because there's certainly a plausible and to many persuasive secular rationale, namely treating all of our citizens equally and justly when there is no good reason, not to do so, when there's no good reason to discriminate. against them. So I'm not sure that's what you were talking. A part of your question was about that, but it doesn't seem to me that there's a problem with that pro same-sex civil union position in terms of my understanding of the non-establishment norm.
You admit that the phrases like under God or God save this court and so forth are not just ceremonial but have real substance, and that they're based on a religious preference. The reason you seem to think that they're compatible with the establishment clause is that they don't depend on a particular religious, a particular church, that they're ecumenical.
Yeah.
Now,
to a point, ecumenical to a point. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, at least very broad.
Yeah.
The broadness of the fact that they're not just Judaic or just Muslim or just
right.
Protestant or whatever.
Right.
Now, it seems to me that if you go to your example of same-sex marriage, that one might make a case, or your case against constitutionality of discrimination against same-sex marriage depends on the fact that, you know, it's only particular churches that object to this, not the broad range of churches. I'm not sure that's even true.
Well, now let me tell you how I...
It seems to me that's one thing that the Judaic, Protestants, Catholics, Muslims seem to agree on, is this particular interpretation of marriage.
Right. That's an important question, and I have not yet finished drafting the work in which I'm going to deal with that. But for better or for worse, here's my thinking at the moment about it. This is a theological proposition about the will of God that is contested within among religious Jews and among Christians, right? At this point, I don't have any doubt that it's contested among religious Muslims, but I don't expect there to be many of them out in public proclaiming about it for obvious reasons, in the way that religious Jews and Christians will. So it seems to me it would make no sense to say that it's okay in terms of the non-establishment norm for government to affirm a partisan position on an issue that is controversial as among the Christians themselves or as among the religious Jews themselves.
So you cite something like the schism in the Episcopal Church over this.
Oh,
that's a good example.
Right, but you can also cite, there are many, many denominations where it's a very divisive issue. Now, it's divisive within Roman Catholicism too. That's a little trickier though, because it's certainly not divisive as far as the magisterium of the church is concerned, the Pope and the bishops. So one might say, don't we need to take that as indicative of where the Catholic Church stands? I'm worried about that position because I know that some of the most eloquent critiques of the magisterium's positions are by Roman Catholic moral theologians publishing in the premier journals of theology, like Theological Studies at the Jesuit Journal here in the United States. But I don't need to wrestle with that, you know, that difficult issue, because I think it's sufficient to say that it doesn't make sense to say that under the non-establishment norm, government may affirm a position, a theological position that is sectarian as among Christians and as among religious Jews.
So if you were to make this case to the Supreme Court, you would have to bring in this controversy within the essential of your argument, this controversy within these
absolutely. That
I say would be a crucial premise.
It is, and I think that's really going to have to be the linchpin of the chapter dealing with that.
Can you tell us who you are, please?
I'm Dylan Swift. I'm a graduate student at Berkeley Body.
Okay.
And you kind of clarified a little bit, because I was going to ask something similar to what he was going to ask, but my thinking is that unless you're privileging like the voice of the people among the Abrahamic faith, that it seems like the only real difference between the under God and the same-sex marriage is whether or not the disavow is materially disadvantaging a group or just psychologically disadvantaging a group. And like, where I mean by the advantaging of or the privileging the Abrahamic faith is because when you're talking about splits between those, like that adds more people who are against it or versus it's a smaller minority who are against it if all of the Abrahamic faiths are for it. Does that make sense?
I'm not confident that I understand what you're saying. If someone wants to help me out in that regard.
And I guess the schism, as you put it, between different sects of Abrahamic faiths with regard to same-sex marriage.
I wouldn't call it a schism, but certainly profound disagreement, internally.
And that seems to me that means that there's some for and some against within that particular group of people. But if you look at the whole of the world, the same can be said for Under God We Trust, just not within that one group, but among the wider community of people that encompasses Buddhism and secularists and atheists. Does that make sense?
Does what make sense? It is true that there are many people in the world and in the United States who disagree with In God We Trust, One Nation Under God, God Save This Honorable Corps, either because they're atheists or agnostics or they're believers, religious believers of non-monotheistic kinds. All of that is undeniably true, but I'm not sure what you're saying about it.
I guess what I'm saying is, in both cases, it seems like there's one group who disavows the religious view and one group that takes on the religious view, but yet it seems like in the case of Under God We Trust, it's only like this psychological issue of whether or not they have to hear Under God We Trust versus with same-sex marriage, there's an actual material disadvantage.
Oh.
The people who...
Well, that's interesting. I mean, one could say to someone who's complaining about One Nation Under God or In God We Trust, one could say to such a person, get a life. Right, you could understand how somebody might respond that way. You know, get a life. What difference does it really make? Aren't you much more aggrieved by a war that's being conducted that you don't support, or this or that? And actually, your point, it seems to me, the refusal of a state to extend the benefit of law to same-sex marriage, if the only discernible rationale is a religious rationale of the sort I've indicated, that yes is much more consequential. I wouldn't even be tempted to say to somebody who objects to that policy, get a life, because we know it can matter a great deal in materially, if you may have put it, but concretely, a policy like that. That's right.
We have time for one more question.
Thank you. Appreciate your time today. I'm Matt Wilson. I work at the university just as staff, so this is interesting for me. I wanted to ask you about the distinction between religious reasons that one may have for voting for law versus being secular. And I guess my thought is, and I wanted to ask your reaction, do you think there's a different standard that is applied to so-called secular evidence, secular proof, secular reasons versus the religious? It seems, though, to me that if you push lawmakers or just people you're talking to, at some point they're going to make a reference to an expert or someone they're just taking on faith or trusting. And so I would just wonder if you think there's a distinction there that maybe on the surface, oh, that's just religious, but aren't really all of us taking some premises on trust that we really couldn't articulate?
Thank you. You notice, maybe you didn't, so let me emphasize it because it's not something that would have been obvious to anyone. I talk about the plausibility or implausibility of secular rationales. I don't talk about the plausibility or implausibility of religious rationales, and there's a reason for that. It is well established in American constitutional law that the courts will look into the plausibility or implausibility of secular rationales, so-called rational basis inquiry, for example. The example I used because of something that was in the news way back when I started teaching, the makers of red dye number 2, the manufacturers of red dye number 2, have been told their dye can't any longer be used in human foodstuffs because it might be carcinogenic. And they're aggrieved. They think there's no evidence for that at all. And in fact, they think that this is interest legislation pushed by the manufacturers of red dye number
3 or red dye number 4. And so the court, in theory at least, will look to see whether there is any case that makes it plausible or rational to think that red dye number 2, unlike red dye number 3, is or might be carcinogenic, a carcinogen. That's fairly standard in constitutional law, more so these days in state courts than in the federal courts. So I'm not introducing any innovation in talking about the plausibility or implausibility of secular rationales. I don't want to talk about the plausibility or implausibility of religious rationales for the obvious reason that we're none of us would be comfortable with the court setting itself up as the arbiter of what's theologically plausible or implausible. So here, the distinction is not between plausible and implausible theological premises. It's between, at least if you accept my spin on what the non-establishment norm means, it's between premises or claims of that fit this profile, plausible or not, and claims that fit this profile, right? So under God is one kind of claim, under Christ, you know, a different kind of claim.
Very good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.